Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to a special bonus episode of Cinematic Universe. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham. No, just kidding. I'm James Hunt, and joining me is...
Michael Leader.
Previous guest, frequent guest. This is probably like your 50th appearance or so.
51st, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we're going to do a short episode based around two films which we saw, or which I saw rather, which have aired at the London Film Festival. My Friend Dharma and Professor Marston and the Wonder Women, both of which are sort of comics adjacent. I think the former definitely counts for the podcast. Yeah. Mm. The second, I think we could get away with it, but I'm not sure we'll get to it in short order. So considering they're of interest to comics fans, I thought we'd just so they're covered in some way. So, Mike, do you want to start with My Friend Dharma?
Yeah, My Friend Dharma. So, I watched this last week. This is one of the ones that we both saw at London Film Festival. It's based on a graphic novel that kind of appeared in installments, but was published as a big chunky book in 2012. And it's a sort of graphic novel, autobiographical memoir, / musing by Durf Backderf. On his like teenage friendship with Jeffrey Dahmer, or as he was known then as Jeff Dahmer, who then went on to become
little Jeff Dahmer.
Whatever happened to that guy?
Yeah,
and yeah, who
went on to become the serial killer Jeff Dahmer? We should point out.
Yeah, and that's sort of the tone of the book. It's recounting these kind of snatches of experience of the weird guy in the class that he and his friends adopted as their mascot in their final couple of years of high school, and sort of obsessively replaying those memories in his mind to see what they could have foreseen or what they might have missed that could have given them clues to what he would become.
Yeah. I mean, so as you can guess, this movie's kind of a laugh riot. Although I say that, it's actually a lot funnier than you'd expect, because like it's very much made in sort of the teen movie tradition. If Spider-Man Homecoming is the, like, teen movie superhero film, this is, like, American Pie meets Silence of the Lambs or something. Like, it's a very strange tone considering the subject matter.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's part of the translation from book to screen. It's a period movie set in the late 70s, or at least in that crossover between the 70s and the 80s culturally. So it feels very much like part Dazed and Confused, the Richard Linklater film, or part Freaks and Geeks. And it focuses in on, well, the book focuses in on Durf and his friends, who are the sort of like slacker wise guys. But the film takes a slightly different approach, which I don't know, might be to the, I think we both agree that's slightly to the detriment of the film, that it focuses in maybe more on Dharma than My Friend Dharma.
Yeah, in fact, like, we were talking, sort of, the book is written entirely from Durf's perspective, as if it, as it's his memoir, but when making the film, they refocused it from Dharma's perspective to sort of give you an insight into things like his home life and sort of things that Durf wouldn't necessarily have seen, but which are sort of part of the historical record of his crimes. And in doing so, it sort of drastically changes the tone of the work. Like it goes from being this kind of what if I hadn't egged him on. What if I hadn't been his friend? What if I'd reached out hard and like more comprehensively? And the film is more like, you know, here's a good kid who goes bad because of his home life.
Yeah, the book ends with these sort of very complicated and conflicted conclusions about not only Durf's kind of culpability in terms of how he and his wise guy friends, kind of smart asses, decided to adopt this guy, this sort of weird kid, and then, you know, cajole him into public acts of weirdness, which they saw as almost the ultimate Steve Martin kind of pranking of like the straight masses.
The normos.
But then he's saying, thinking back, you could see between the cracks a broken home life, a sort of nascent alcoholism, a sort of a discomfort with sexuality, and also a broader comment about the latchkey kid generation, where kids were let loose and not necessarily, you know, looked after by the adults and people in power around them. And it's a really interesting perspective in the book throughout. And once you take out, you know, say the narration or that perspective on the narrative, it becomes much more tragic in a way that may excuse the crimes or see almost a direct link between, say, a broken home life or confusions around feelings towards other men.
Mm-hmm.
It draws a direct line in a way that makes the film a bit too simplistic in a way.
Yeah, and it's strange, isn't it? Because, like, you know, these things are all matters of public record. Like, you know, his trial and various things, like, brought to light exactly how his, you know, how he was allowed to get this way and sort of the psychological underpinnings of what turned out to be things like cannibalism and necrophilia.
Yeah, yeah.
That the film doesn't really go into. It just sort of paints this picture of a kid who was failed by the authorities and, you know, the adults in his life and, to an extent, his friends, who in other respects appears to be quite normal, and there are only very minor nods to what he'll become. And it doesn't really try to analyse whether there was any sort of nature versus nature argument. As near as I can tell, the film just assumes this kid could have not been a serial killer, whereas I think Dharma had problems that would have led him down that path anyway. Like, I don't know, it just seems a lot more complex than Mark Meyer, who made the film, seems to think.
Yeah, it's probably something we can say for both films we'll talk about today, in almost like a flip side, two sides of the same coin. The film takes one step back and doesn't provide some of the lurid or voyeuristic or sort of scandalous aspects that, if you think of other films about serial killers, say Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer being one of the classics of the genre and so on, films that really go into the grotesqueness or into the unseemliness of what serial killers are and what they mean as part of a culture. It doesn't go there, so it means the tone of the film is very well handled in the mixture of sort of comedy, drama, tragedy, melancholy, but it makes it a much more straightforwardly melancholic film rather than anything. I don't say exciting. I didn't want this film to be more exciting or horrific. You know, Durf's, what's great about Durf is that his cartooning style is very much influenced by the sort of San Francisco kind of alternative comics. It's very grotesque in its forms and figures. So when, for example, one of Dharma's kind of pranks would be to throw what was sort of epileptic fit or something in the middle of a shopping mall, and the way that Dev draws it, it looks kind of grotesque and really terrifying.
It looks upsetting.
Yeah. Whereas Ross Lynch, who plays Dharma in this, he plays a very good kind of sad and sorrowful performance of a boy left adrift in a society that isn't just there for him to support him. But he is too pristine, really.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of cheap shot to make is that he's a former Disney kid who is on the Disney Channel, been in Disney TV movies and has a Disney recording career, and now this is his equivalent of doing, you know, going against that.
Going against type, yeah.
But it's not necessarily an ugly performance at all.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the performances, I think his performance is actually really good, even though he's, like, in real life, he's, like, the super attractive Disney kid. I think he's got talent, and I think it's more that he wasn't directed in the right way, maybe, or shot in the right way. One of the best things you can say about this film is that the central performance is, like, just really engaging. Like, it's charismatic, definitely.
It's a very well-made film all round, really. The sense of time and place, this sort of, like, this suburb that isn't necessarily an affluent suburb, but it's a leafy one, winding roads and isolated houses in the woods and so on. As I kind of hinted at, this maintenance of tone, treading a line between comedy and drama. And tragedy and quite unpleasant undertones. It's all there. It's just there isn't anything to really knock it out of the park for me. And it would be a fantastic... I'd love to dig into the production story for this. things that maybe were changed along the way. Because you know that when you're making a film of this level, of this type, this was a Tribeca Film Festival premiere, independently made. Mark Myers had made a few films beforehand, but neither of us had heard of them. And this is his first one with, I'd say, recognisable faces and names. Mm-hmm. So Anne Hesch plays his mum, Dana's mum, which is crazy. I've not seen her in anything for a long time. And it's kind of like, I've not seen her since the 90s in a film.
It's a strong performance.
Really good performance. And then I always forget his name, but Connor from Angel.
Vincent Kartheiser.
That's not the primary credit for him anymore.
Yeah,
he's also in Mad Men as Pete Campbell, isn't he?
Yeah, that's the guy.
He's great. He plays the sort of local doctor who becomes a sort of figure of discomforting and confusing feelings for Dharma.
Yeah, in fact, I can't remember whether this is true to the history or not. When Dharma was in, at this age, he did try and kill a jogger. But the jogger, like, who regularly went past his house, who didn't appear.
Right.
And isn't that the jogger? Isn't he the jogger?
I think there are two joggers, aren't there?
Yeah.
There's definitely the doctor is... When he meets the doctor, he's not actually Dharma's GP. In the film, it's a bit of a fiddly scene.
Yeah.
He's actually Durf's GP, that they meet him in the parking lot of a convenience store or something. And it's like, oh, who's that guy? He always runs outside my house. It's part of... There are some just fiddly aspects to the screenplay that didn't quite work for me. And that's one of them, this threading all the way through that we know that he's going to probably kill somebody, but who is he going to kill?
Mm-hmm.
And they even, I think, go so as far to kind of, put, main characters in danger. And it's like, oh, is he going to murder them now? And just comes across as a bit insincere or disingenuous.
Especially since... Like, if you know the historical record, like, basically everyone there is sort of immune because they're not, the people he killed are known and the circumstances in which they died are known.
Well, because he got away with it for years.
And, he
didn't freak out and murder everybody in a school or something. He actually sort of kept it out over quite a long time. Mm-hmm. And that's... It's funny because what I find so fascinating about the book is that the book has this sort of Stand By Me aspect to it, which is a portrait of quite a small period in the lives of a few characters. But then at the end, it opens up in perspective to it's now 20, 30 years later. I'm looking back at my life and how much this peripheral figure in my social group at school has defined me and defined my relationships with my friends as we've grown older. Mm-hmm. And it's this... I can really see how picking up that book and then looking at some other film texts like Dazed and Confused or Freaks and Geeks or Stand By Me or whatever, or even It, with this sort of structure where it's things that happen as childhood kind of coming back and haunting people in later life. You can really see how that would track and play out on screen. But along the way, clearly some little changes have been made to make what could have been a quite a brilliant film into something that is very well made and competent. And I'd love to see what everyone does next. But I can really see why it's not been a breakout hit in a way.
Yeah.
Critically.
Quite. I mean, I think I have to say what's bad about the film, I kind of lay at the feet of Mark Meyer. Because, like, the performances are there, like, the cinematography's great, like, even the direction is good, but I think what it lacks is, like, a thesis. Like, it doesn't have a take on Dharma that isn't just, like, the idea that he might have been okay. And, like, when I saw the Q&A and he talks about wanting to make the character sympathetic and sort of, you know, work out what made him this way. And I think, like I say, I think that's a simplistic way to look at murderers, certainly. And, like, there are scenes which I believe were created for the movie. Like, he kidnaps a dog, attempts to kill it, and fails.
Yeah.
And not even, like, he can't bring himself to do it. And it's like, that scene exists solely to make us go, like, oh, maybe he's not too far gone. Whereas in reality, he'd been kidnapping and murdering pets for years by that point.
Mm.
And, like, the Dharma of this point in real life would not have had any trouble doing that.
Mm.
Like, I feel like he went too far in sort of... My worry about this film is that all the sort of Disney kid fans of Ross Lynch are going to come out of it going like, oh my God, Jeffrey Dahmer was so misunderstood.
And so hot.
And so hot, yeah. Which is not the case. Like, apparently he was quite attractive. For the era, but he's not made into enough of a disquieting figure. I mean, part of the problem as well is that compression of the memoir, which covers a vast span of time, into 1 year. And so when we start the film, he's like essentially a sort of normal kid who has a slightly weird obsession with dissolving roadkill. And he, over the course of that 1 year, which is framed as, like, between the two proms, like the junior and senior prom, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not being hugely familiar with American high school traditions. It frames it as, like, oh, well, his family broke apart and, you know, these friends pushed him towards being crazier and weirder. And, you know, his parents abused him and he became an alcoholic. And then he started killing things. And it's like that was going on for probably a decade plus in real life.
Yeah,
whereas the film narrows it down and says, like, oh, look how quickly it all went wrong.
And it really kind of gives it a sort of ABC sense of inevitability to it, which I think is something that Durf in the original book is really resistant to. He doesn't attempt to explain or excuse the behaviour. It's just there's that incredible tension about trying to just wrestle with your memories and your memories of your friends.
Mm-hmm.
The book, in fact, reminds me a little bit of Waltz with Bashir, the documentary of, you know, Israeli armed forces, former Israeli armed forces soldiers trying to figure out the trauma of what they went through, and it's the main characters going through, you know, trying to, by talking to other people, just figure out what you went through. And but that's not what the film of Dharma is. It's funny. It's an interesting one. It's such an interesting film to talk about and pull apart and then as a jumping off point. But I don't think the freaky weirdos who like watching DVDs of films about serial killers are going to get much from this film, really. Because there is another Dharma film, isn't there? It's Jeremy Renner.
Yeah, yeah. That was his breakout film, even, wasn't it?
I've not seen that one.
No, me neither.
But it's interesting. I love listening to the podcast, but quite separate from the podcast, I love singling out comic book movies that aren't obvious comic book movies, and Dharma's been on my radar for some time, and but I can't help but feel a little bit disappointed in a way, because I want graphic novel adaptations into film to be, you know, to show how incredible some of these stories and points of view and perspectives are.
Yeah,
and I feel that this could have been any festival level indie movie, really.
That's almost its crime, isn't it? It's like, it's so sort of, I don't want to say generic, but I kind of do mean generic.
Yeah, but
because, like, it's not that it's uninventive, even, it's just that it, you know, you feel like you've seen it before, and for a film about a serial killer growing up in high school, that's an odd thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in some ways, that's its strength. Like, is that it nails the high school tone really well, but it just doesn't add anything else. I mean, I think we've fairly comprehensively gone over that. I don't want to talk too much about these films because none of them are theatrically released yet, so I don't want spoilers in there.
Mm-hmm. It's not really a spoiler to say that he turns into a serial killer. There's not really much to spoil about this film, really. When I saw it, it's not up there for me. Thankfully, Death of Stalin, which was my other sort of alternative comic book movie adaptation, was great. So that's fine.
So just two quick questions about the movie then.
Uh-huh.
Would you recommend people see it?
So two levels of recommend, I guess. Would you go and pay £15 at your local boutique cinema that's probably going to be the only one showing this? Probably not. But then also, it's very likely that this might just end up on Amazon Prime or Netflix in a year anyway, and if you're intrigued, you could watch it. Quite a short film.
Yeah, I don't feel like you'll waste time watching it, whether you'll get a huge amount out of it if you have to pay a ton of money. It's not really a good Saturday night out, I'll say that much. I feel like it's intriguing as a study of an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
But if you haven't read the comic, you probably won't have that to latch onto. And speaking of which, you should definitely read the comic.
The comic's great. It's one of those ones that it's the sort of thing that tends to fall through the cracks if you're just a sort of image and mainstream comics reader. Because it's put out on it's like Abrams Comic Arts, whatever the publisher is, and it'll be in your local comic book store and probably Waterstones or wherever, but it's not the sort of thing that...
it's not going to be in the window of Forbidden Planet.
No, exactly.
Well, quite interestingly, the first time I became aware of this as a comic was in 2002, when I saw it on the shelves in the Forbidden Planet commentary, actually. And I remember flicking through, because what happened was, he did a lot of short stories, then he collected them all as a single 22-page pamphlet comic.
Mm.
And then later on, after finally getting a commission, did a 200-page book version, which is the sort of current one. But at the time, I didn't buy the pamphlet originally because, as you say, it was in that San Francisco comics with an X tradition.
Yeah.
And I just wasn't ready for it. Like, I wasn't prepared to get past the artwork's inherent ugliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people might leave it on the shelf because of that. And all I can say is it was a mistake when I did it. So it's a mistake if you do it. Although I did end up buying the pamphlet version off his website when it was nominated for an Eisner.
It was quite a success and quite well regarded in its own way. I think what probably harms it is that he's not somebody like an Adrian Tomine or Chris Ware, who then went on to put out three or four more books or a book every couple of years.
Yeah, in fact, what happened was he had a pretty serious bout with cancer before, and having beat that, went on to do the full size book version,
but that I haven't read his other book is him a autobiography about being a garbage man. So it is.
Yeah.
I've not read that one. I mean, that is just the exact kind of almost stereotypical example of that sort of book, isn't it? Where you're going to the planet and there's a weird book about someone being a garbage man. And it's like, do I want to pick this up or do I want to pick up the new Jeff Lemire? And yeah, exactly. My Friend Arm is great. It's such a good book.
Yeah, that's a double recommendation on the comic. So, do you want to go straight into the next one?
Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah. So, the follow-up is, or the other film, which you saw at Toronto Film Festival, I believe?
Yes, I saw it nearly a month ago at Toronto, so please excuse if my memory is a bit hazy.
Yeah, I saw it 2 days ago at London Film Festival, which is Professor Marston and the Wonder Women. It's a biographical film about William Moulton Marston, the man who created Wonder Woman, and the women who I guess we can call his two wives, Elizabeth Marston and Olive Byrne. And yeah. Essentially it chronicles their meeting and the forming of their polyamorous relationship and the subsequent creation of Wonder Woman.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of the fallout from all of that. I know what I thought of it. What did you make of it?
Oh, I absolutely loved it. This is a film that where the first trailer came out a few months ago. It's sort of gone a little bit under the radar because I really would have thought that a film with Rebecca Hall and Luke Evans in about the creation of Wonder Woman should have been especially, on everyone's radar.
Especially this year. This well, year of any year.
They suddenly got around March, April, started releasing teaser material for it. And then the first trailer came out and I was thinking, this could be really interesting. But what can't be really captured in the synopsis or the trailer is just how sort of classically elegant this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
And also in its construction, in its tone and style, but then also how intelligently made it is in terms of how dense its themes. I joked with you about this earlier, James, but I can say it on record now in a Cinematic Universe episode. This is a Joe movie. This is a Joe Cunningham movie. There's so much in there, the structure and then the characters and their relationships, power relationships and themes, both personal, political, creative, textual, subtextual, you know, etc. It's just got so much in there.
Mm-hmm.
And also a pair of, well, I think nearly all the performances, Luke Evans, Rebecca Hall and Bella Heathcote are the main three, but Rebecca Hall in particular, who's one of my favourite actresses.
Yeah, like Rebecca, Iron Man 3 is Rebecca Hall.
Yes.
Absolutely destroys this movie. Like, she is so good in it. Like, I genuinely think that anyone who sees this is going to come out loving her if they don't already. And that's not to say the others aren't good, but I think she is, like, she inhabits this unique and sort of surprising character so completely that almost when she's not on screen, you're just like, when's Rebecca Hall coming back?
She also has an amazing kind of mid-Atlantic accent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's becoming quite a great kind of accent actor. She was in Christine last year, one of the two films that came out last year about Christine Chubbuck, the local news anchor who shot herself live on television.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a really dark, dark and upsetting, but quite wonderful portrait of a woman kind of unraveling. And yeah, she's brilliant in that. And this is just keeping that winning streak going. Mm-hmm. I really hope she gets some attention.
Yeah.
But we should really set up kind of what it's about, because there's so much in this film.
Yeah.
Really. And I know that you want to talk about how its historical accuracy, and in a way I don't particularly care as much about historical accuracy, because this film works for me on the level of it being almost an essayistic investigation into what it is to create and what it is to love and what it is to have ideals and to live by them, and in a way that it reminds me almost more of something like Inside Llewyn Davis or I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan movie,
mm-hmm.
where it says more about historical figures and periods and times than something that is by the letter historical.
Yeah, so what you've done there has made me sound like a nitpicker.
No, it's actually it's really important because the points of departure and the still made a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to still talk about that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't think any ways it diverged from historical record make it bad necessarily, which is something that, you know, I think with Dharma as well, like, if you're making a film, you can't be 100% accurate all the time, and the act of writing a screenplay and deciding what to keep in and what to leave out is in itself a form of sort of untruth. So, you know, you don't go into these things looking for 100% honest accuracy. So on that level, it doesn't bother me, because as you say, the film is so good. On another, there are things that I'm surprised they changed.
Right.
Like for a start, the film opens with them sort of collecting comic books. Mm. And as soon as I saw that scene happening, I was really excited, because I was like, oh, they're doing the Wortham stuff.
Yeah.
Because like, that's such a big moment for comics, and I don't know how in the public consciousness it is. And so I was really sort of impressed that they started with that.
Yeah. We need the Cavalier and Clay movie to come out.
Yeah.
Then we'll know.
Although it's kind of... This is something that I think is a problem with the historical accuracy, is that there are some things in there which are so on the nose that it almost feels like they've been made up. Like how Olive walks around with like these giant sort of metal bracelets on.
Right.
And if this was like, if you weren't familiar with the history, you'd be going, come off it. Like, have some subtlety. And yet that's what actually happened. Like, it's on record that he based the bracelets on a pair of olives.
Right.
So
well, that's the thing that the film does really well. It has a whole sequence about the two Marstons, both William and Elizabeth, and their research as kind of, you know, psychologists and at the forefront of certain radical theories about domination and interpersonal relationships. They were also deep into the research that developed the first lie detector. So it sets up this scene where they are academics, first and foremost, but quite edgy academics invested in the suffrage movement or women's rights.
I would
say
they're radical academics.
Radical academics. And then Bella Heathcote, Olive Byrne, comes into their lives, and it sets up the kind of polyamorous aspect of their relationship there. Meanwhile, there's this, and when I say classically constructed, this is what I mean, there's this fantastic device all the way through where it flashes back and forth with what I imagine is part of the, it's standing in for the Wortham kind of era, mm-hmm. where it's Connie Britton doing quite close reading of Wonder Woman, attacking Marston, saying you're peddling filth and perverting the minds of children. And then flashing back and forth, building this sort of unique character relationship, which just by the fact that it's a polyamorous kind of bisexual relationship is almost a first on screen in a way for a movie of this kind. But then, as you say, with the bracelets, it then starts dropping in references that was pulled together to create Wonder Woman, including, a fascination with bondage, which becomes parts of the ropes and so on. Mm-hmm. But then it is also effortlessly then woven in with Marston's primary research into dominance and submission, and how it's only through submission to a willing submission and conformity to a higher authority. To a loving authority that we can be happy. And how he then, as part of creating Wonder Woman and creating these stories, how would Twitter put it? foisted his agenda on the readers.
No, they used to keep politics out of comics, you understand.
But that's what's amazing, and that's what's something that really that I responded.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I've said before that my favorite part of the first Avenger is where Captain America is shown as being pretty much just a comic book character in support of the war effort to sell war bonds. And that's one of the only moments where the Marvel Universe has actually kind of looked upon itself and what the comics medium is. And this film is exactly that, breaking open what comics could be, what comics was, what comics is as an art form. And Marston and his and the women that, you know, that inspired him and helped him really believed in comics as a medium for change, for effective change, for inspiration, for
delivery of ideas.
For delivery of ideas, and not just it really, because the Golden Age is kind of laughed at a lot now for being, you know, primary colours and silly concepts and quite kind of bald-faced ideologies. But it's so interesting that this film manages to then have a deep reading into the inner workings of a comic. I know that's a perspective, and I don't know if it really holds up as a... I've never really read Wonder Woman too deeply, so I can't tell whether it's true to the comic or true to the character. But in a world where really Stan Lee's take on what comics characters should be is held up as gospel. It's so interesting to have that played out in a film.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that sort of interests me about, like, the Golden Age of comics is kind of laughed at as simplistic and sort of half-formed. But actually, the people writing those comics sort of knew what they were doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you know, it's not an accident that they're, like, shouting slogans at one another and stuff. Like, you know, it's partially a joke, but also it's intended to sort of speak to simpler minds. Like, it, you know, there's complexity in the ideas, but they're being deliberately distilled, and it's easy to look at those comics and say, well, they're, you know, they're simple and lack adult complexity, and it's like, well, yeah, but that's how they were designed.
And that's what's kind of so pointed in this film, is that these comics are being made to make young boys respect women. And it's like, this is Angela Robinson, who's written and directed this, who is kind of primarily known now as, you know, she was a director and writer on The L Word. She was involved in you know, True Blood and so on. She's a TV person. She's not a comics nerd. It's not, you know, when nerds write books, you know, we get Ready Player One. meanwhile, we have this, which is just such a work that really gets what art can be, and looks at comics and sees potential and explores that.
It's weirdly sort of political and relevant still. Like, that's what I find surprising, is that it's doing stories set broadly almost 100 years ago. Like, the first half of the film at least is set in the 1920s.
Yeah. And it's that sort of interwar era, isn't it?
Yeah, and like, it remains sort of politically vital.
Exactly. And that's that's just a testament to how radical they were then, and some of the concepts are still radical now. You know, as we've said about, you know, keeping politics out of comics, you know, that's something that is a battleground on Twitter every day, or keeping female characters out of comics, you know. This film isn't afraid of the work that the great people that its lives it's telling made. There are so many biopics, and this is, you know, I should probably say, this, the way this film is made, the look of it, the tone of it, is really not a million miles away from the sort of Oscar Beatty biopic.
I tell you what I was reminded of, and that was A Dangerous Method.
Well, oh really? It's okay, I can see what you mean there, where, with the sort of BDSM elements, I guess, but it's but really, you could, if you kind of wandered in halfway through a scene and then wandered out, you could mistake this for something like The Imitation Game or The Theory of Everything or Suffragette from a couple of years ago. Or one film I saw in Toronto, I think the day before this, was The Current War, which is a film, I mean, that's a terrible title, that's a pun. It's The Current War, meaning the Edison versus Tesla versus the other people who were trying to light up the Northeast Seaboard in the kind of late 19th century. And it's a really cack-handed film. It's got some amazing... I mean, it's a time in history that is fascinating. It's characters that are fascinating. And it's it's almost the age of miracles, because every day you are having time collapsed in terms of night suddenly being open to people. Mm-hmm. You're having telephones, so distance was being collapsed, and train travel and flights and everything, and it just doesn't know how to explore those creations. Whereas what this film does, what Professor Marston does, is it manages to explore all that, and it means that nerds like us can respond to the comic book element of it, mm-hmm. whilst also a more mainstream audience or an audience with a different perspective will watch this and see a really radical film about sexuality and desire and romance in a polyamorous setting, which it does both equally well and manages to have each side of that coin feed off each other. It's, you know, it's I'm stunned by it.
And yeah. It's worth pointing out as well, because Film Festival, there was a Q&A after the screening I saw, and I think every polyamorous grouping in London must have been at that screening, judging by the Q&A. Like, and they were all really pleased with the depiction of their lifestyle and sort of how it gets it. So mm-hmm. even in that sense, it's a film that is sensitive rather than titillating. Like, if you try and imagine how 50 Shades of Grey approaches BDSM, it is the polar opposite of that.
It manages to really present it as romantic and an aspect of their relationship.
And consensual from the, you know, top to... I shouldn't say top to bottom. Consensual at every level.
But then also, kind of what I meant with... what I said when we were talking about Dharma is that it's not a titillating or lurid film. It's it's quite adult in that sense, that it doesn't feel the need to kind of laugh or push any sort of taboo or push a button with the representation here. It just presents it as
matter of fact
and a key component of their relationship. And it's amazing, it's not a spoiler because it's part of their relationship history, but it just says that they come together and say, the Marstons can live as man and wife. Olive can be living with them, and then it flashes forward, and then suddenly they've got like 8 kids together, and they've managed to make it work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really foist too much drama or melodrama or incident on this relationship.
Yeah,
that's not required. And I really hope that this film doesn't get lost because it's not kind of edgy enough, or you know, it happens every year that there's the sort of middle brow. I think this is technically middle brow. I know that's mainly used as a disparaging term, but it's a film that provides you with the sort of the romance and the sweep of a classical biopic or biographical drama, but also has some real ambition and ideas behind it. So it's kind of both doing both so well, but there's a tendency for those films to suddenly disappear when Oscar season comes around and the debate and the discourse forms around certain films. And you see it happening already with The Shape of Water, which is brilliant, the Guillermo del Toro film. And I don't really know what else. I guess we'll see once January comes around. But I hope this stays.
I would love for this to get Oscars, but I don't think it will. Like, as brilliant as it is, I think it's too small time.
I really hope original screenplay would be, you know, in its future. That would be brilliant. And
I think as good as the performances are, it's missing, like, you know, it's not an actor's performance. Like, the performances are good, but all in service of the story. It's not like, what's the Leonardo DiCaprio bear film?
The Revenant. It's not got...
It's not a Revenant. Yeah.
Well, the Revenant... The thing with the Revenant performance by Leo is that the entire performance was an Oscar montage performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this isn't that.
No. It's sort of... The film, in a way, reminds me of Loving from last year.
Yeah.
Which was Jeff Nichols. And a very just beautifully handled film with a couple of performances at the heart of it. Ruth Negger, in particular, was just beautiful in that film. And, like, couldn't be further away from Tulip in Preacher. But it was just a little bit too small, a little bit too quiet, didn't have the money behind it or the sort of the powerhouse production companies behind it to make an Oscar play.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of have to believe, though, in the year of Wonder Woman,
yeah,
the audience for this film is there, and I have to believe they're going to find it.
Is it out really soon in the States?
Is it this weekend even?
October 13th.
Yeah.
Quick. Okay. Upload this.
Yeah. So, it's out next month in the UK. So, it's pretty quick turnaround on it.
Yeah, it only had its world premiere at Toronto in September, so that's really quick turnaround. Yeah. But I wonder whether... Well, from my point of view, I don't know how you feel about this, James, but this is the second film about Wonder Woman released in a year that was written and directed by a woman, and this is by far my favourite of the two. I wasn't swept away by Wonder Woman in the way that some people were, and I really appreciate the way that people were. I would never take that away from people, the rush that film gave, but for me, that this film was just so accomplished on every level.
I mean, I'm trying to think before I say this, like, it might be my favourite of the year.
Oh wow, really?
Well, I mean, I've been looking forward to it for so long, and it delivered on everything that I wanted it to. And like, this whole period of comics history is something I'm massively interested in anyway. So like, in addition to being brilliantly crafted and intelligent and sort of so clear about what it thought and what it wanted to say and all of that stuff, it also happens to be like something I'm super interested in. And I can't wait to see it again.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Just simply because I love those sorts of films that really dig into characters and lives and concepts. And, this will go down alongside Inside Llewyn Davis and I'm Not There, and films that even something like, I mean, this is very different, of course, but something like 24 Hour Party People, which takes lives and stories and cultural texts that you know, but then tries to pull them apart and make them speak for them in ways beyond the text. Yeah, we'll see.
And so I just want to talk quickly. We mentioned about how it's kind of talking about the kind of simplistic nature of comics and how they can be used to deliver ideas and stuff. And in a way, that is this film as well, isn't it? Like, we talked after I saw it about how, even though at times it has to be necessarily simple because it's got sort of hour and a half and change to tell what is essentially a story spanning sort of 40, 50 years of history with vast political and social upheaval happening around it. But at the same time, it reminds you that simplistic narratives are actually capable of, and in many ways a better way of delivering complex ideas than comics. Than complex ones.
Well, exactly, yeah. And it's kind of simplistic narrative frameworks, really.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've said this, I might have said this when I've been on the podcast before, but what I love about comics is that a comic story could be, five panels long, 10 pages long, 23 pages long, or 1,000 pages long, and it could be, it just takes the right creator to have the right idea. And that's why I've been in so many conversations with people recently about how cinema's dead because television happens. But this is why I still love film, because it's the restrictions, and they only have an hour and 45. You could probably have made the version of this that was a 10-part Netflix series and had 3 episodes on them burning comic books and being called in front of committees and so on, but that's not, I'd find that boring in a way. I love the restrictions, and I love how it inspires kind of concision and economy of storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. So, again, would you recommend people see this film?
Oh, very strongly. Especially if you're even vaguely interested in this.
Yeah, and I assume if you're listening to this podcast, and essentially if you've got this far into the podcast, you should be pre-ordering your ticket as soon as possible.
I agree.
it just is incredible.
It really is, yeah. It makes me want to go and read some Wonder Woman comics.
I had that exact feeling. I was like, I should go and read some Wonder Woman comics from the 1940s, which is something that even I previously would have put on the back burner.
Well, yeah, because you only tend to see those, comics in general from the Golden Age, kind of in those compilations of the weirdest comics of all time, or the characters that didn't make it, and all that, and it's very rare to be inspired to go and watch.
I think especially with Wonder Woman, like, Marston was well ahead of his time. So I think in that sense, it's one like 1940s Wonder Woman will probably benefit from a closer reading more than, say, 1940s Superman or Batman did.
Clearly, yeah, I agree. Yeah. Although, you know, I made the crack about we're waiting for the Cavalier and Clay film, which, you know, the Michael Chabon book. But that's actually quite a similar text, but taking on Superman and the other Golden Age heroes. But it's completely fictionalized, but with characters at the periphery that are recognizable. But it really just busts open aspects of the Superman myth and the you know, the stories of its creators, and explores the whole way that Jewish backgrounds and, you know, working class New York Manhattan upbringings can
the immigrant story.
The immigrant story,
exactly. Again, comics, not political.
Right.
It's not actually adapted from a book, but there is a book which I've just bought, and I'm, what, 5 chapters into, and it's frankly stunning, which is called The Secret History of Wonder Woman by Jill Lepore. I'm fairly sure, based on the amount of reference notes in it, that it was at some point an academic text, but it's very well written. It's got lots of illustrations of 1940s Wonder Woman comics, and it's even got a nice glossy photo section in the middle.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's, you know, unlike nearly all of those other books, like the Glenn Weldon books and the Sean Harrow Marvel book, which are, you don't get any pictures in those.
Yep. So
is it pictures of Wonder Woman or pictures of Marston, etc.?
It has pictures of Wonder Woman in the glossy bit, but the other illustrations are black and white. There are a lot of black and white photos of Marston in his lab and, what, Marston and his wives, Marston and his children. Like, it's all in here.
Great, okay. It's not a spoiler to say that they don't look like Luke Evans and Rebecca Hall. Right?
No, they are very much the homely 1940s people they are.
Yeah.
But you imagine your grandparents to have been.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy. I don't want to think of that.
So I would recommend getting hold of that book. It's like £5 on Kindle and a tenner in physical copy. Yeah. And again, comes with the stamp of recommendation because I read the start of it now, having bought it the day after seeing the film, and I'm loving it.
I'm looking forward to, so if it comes out in the States on the 13th, I'm looking forward to at 5 past midnight on October 14th for the 10 things Professor Marston gets wrong about Wonder Woman think pieces to come out.
I mean, there is, just before we sign off, there is one very surprising aspect obviously it glosses over a lot of stuff, like the fact that Marston worked as a writer before creating the character of Wonder Woman. Like, I've already learned from the screenplay I've already learned from the book that he wrote what were then called photoplays for early silent movies as a way of supporting himself through college.
That's interesting.
Yeah, wow. In fact, to flash back to our earlier chat about the current war, he wrote stuff for Edison's company.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's a shame that we can't have the Edison Cinematic Universe then.
Well, quite. But yeah, the thing that surprises me is that they left out Elizabeth suggesting that the superhero Marston creates should be female.
Right.
Which to me, like, it's a fairly major aspect of her input. Like, he was creating a superhero who wasn't necessarily female, and she said something worse to the effect of, you damn well better make her a woman.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, that's given that Olive was the model for the character, it strikes me that's the missing piece of the puzzle in terms of bringing all three of them together to create Wonder Woman.
Yeah. I'm sure this is, it's such a sort of considered film. I'm sure that it was for a reason, for some sort of flow or something, but it's surprising.
Yeah. I mean, that's why the reference text exists.
Yeah,
the movie is good, the book is good, and they are necessarily different.
Exactly. I'd love to interview Angela Robinson about this. I'd love to see just, you know, what goes into a film like this.
Definitely.
And how you had a writer-director who seems more invested in a character than sometimes the actual writers and directors of that character's big-budget movies.
Someone did ask at the Q&A, would you do your own Wonder Woman movie? And it's like, well, obviously, yes. But also, the day you get a black queer female director doing your big budget Hollywood sequel is a long way off.
Yeah, we need to do them, do all those adjectives individually first.
Yeah, quite.
or at all.
Yeah. She was very complimentary about Patty Jenkins as a Wonder Woman, though, I should point out. There were no sour grapes.
Interesting. I wonder if... Did they ever work on similar things together, like TV credits?
Apparently. An interesting thing she said was, while she was developing this film, she said something like, I spoke to the woman who did an early draft of what became the Wonder Woman movie.
Oh. Do you remember who that could have been?
I don't know off the top of my head. But, you know, I'm assuming it wasn't the Joss Whedon version, because I don't think any of that went into the finished film. So yeah, I think we said everything we need to about both of those movies. One great, one not so great, but neither necessarily bad. Like, I find it interesting when the worst thing you can say about a film is, I don't really agree with all it was doing. Because like, sometimes you watch a film and it's just a trash fire. And neither of these are trash fires, they're both well considered. But in one case, I don't agree with what it was saying.
I mean, to be really simplistic, it's a three-star film and a potential five-star film, really.
Yeah.
But Professor Marston, I really hope people go and see.
Me too. If you only see one of these films, it should definitely be Professor Marston. And in fact, if you only see one film this year, it should probably be Professor Marston or Thor Ragnarok, which I'm going to see next week.
That's coming up. I can't wait.
Not to rub the fact that we're film critics in your face or anything.
I mean, that's one of those films where, you know, they were doing the premiere stuff last night on Twitter, and it's like, I'd forgotten Jeff Goldblum was in it. Or it's just like, because, you know, you think of Thor Ragnarok, you think of Thor and, you know, the main characters. And it's like, oh no, but then also Cate Blanchett. And it's, yeah, there are so many things in that to look forward to.
Yep. So me and Mike are going to be seeing Thor Ragnarok next week, and there'll be a Cinematic Universe episode about it in a couple of weeks, I imagine. You can find out what we thought about it then.
I can't wait.
Me neither. If anything's going to knock Professor Marston off the top,
it's a shame that Shape of Water is coming out next year, because I'd probably say that that might knock it off.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's really good. I'd say that's almost comics adjacent, because it's Guillermo del Toro doing a sort of quiet Hellboy inspired film, because it's definitely inspired by Abe Sapien.
Yeah, interesting.
The main character.
That possibly preempts my last question, which was just going to be, what else at the London Film Festival did you think was worth seeing?
I'd probably say that is the big one. That's the movie that, when it comes out in February or January, is going to be definitely worth seeing. It's Guillermo del Toro kind of doing this sweeping fantasy romance that also has a really weird kind of, in like a creepy fed, like, kind of fetishy kind of way, weird vibe, because it's Sally Hawkins sort of fish man. a mute fish man in an Area 51 style facility developing a loving romance.
We've all been there.
I remember when I was there. But it's just brilliant, and it's developing the momentum from Venice and Toronto of almost being an Oscar contender.
Wow.
Which will be the strangest Oscar nominee for a long time. That's the film I saw in Toronto that I thought was really good. It probably would be, out of the London Film Festival selection, one of my favourites. But then there's also Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which is the new film from Martin McDonagh, who did In Bruges. And it's Frances McDormand as one of her first leading roles since Fargo, just completely tearing things up. She's such a good actress and is so patient and in her own world that she doesn't chase the spotlight, and it's amazing when she is in the spotlight. It's a great film.
Yeah, I mean, In Bruges is probably one of my all-time top 10 definitely films. Like, I love it like nothing else.
Imagine that, but it's a sort of very dark humoured sad comedy drama. With a great cast. It's Woody Harrelson and Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell and all sorts of people.
Yeah, I mean, sounds good. Yeah.
That's going to be one of the other big Oscar players, I imagine. At least Frances McDormand would be up there.
Sure.
What have you seen, James?
I have seen I saw Have a Nice Day, which was a Chinese animation that turned out not to be great. It's kind of done in a sort of pulpy, pulp fiction-y style. It was okay. It looked better than it... The stills looked better than the animation, which was a shame. And I also saw Tiger Girl, which is fully improvised, impressively. A fully improvised movie about... Wow. Sort of anarcho, German anarcho punks living in Berlin, kind of kicking against authority. It's about, like, essentially one girl learning to be a security guard meets the antithesis of that. It's kind of A Clockwork Orange / Kill Your Boyfriend type movie. Like, I really enjoyed it. It's never going to be Oscar material. At best, it's going to turn up on Netflix as one of those weird films that gets 3 stars and you skip over, but it's a 3-star film that I had a 5-star reaction to, because it's just all the stuff I find fun and interesting. It's like, it's themed around these sort of two female leads who are kind of teens without much on in their lives, or young adults, I should say, because they're probably in their 20s. And it's about, like, violence as an escape from boredom. Which is one of the things I loved about Kill Your Boyfriend. In fact, I'm so sure it was influenced by Kill Your Boyfriend, because which is the Grant Morrison comic that I talk about all the time. So if you're listening to the podcast, I'm sure you've heard of it.
It was a recommendation way back when, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely been a recommendation. Because in Kill Your Boyfriend, the first time the lead girl meets the boy is when he kicks a car window in. And the first time it happened that the lead girl meets the other sort of more anarchic girl in this film, she kicks the wing mirror off a car. It's so similar to Kill Your Boyfriend that I kind of think it must be an influence. Or maybe they're both homaging the same thing, I don't know. But that's the kind of vibe I got.
I'll look for that. It's got Ella Rumpf in it, who was really good in Raw last year. She was the older sister.
Yeah.
The older sister in Raw. And yeah, she looks amazing in all of the stills for this.
Mm-hmm.
She looks really kind of kick-ass.
Yeah, it's a fun film.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Oh, and I also saw Jailbreak, which is a Cambodian martial arts movie. It's the first action film to come out of Cambodia since the war.
Right.
To make it, they were on such a shoestring budget that they couldn't afford to fly in stuntmen from Thailand. They had to get the one guy to train 75 stuntmen for the film.
Wow.
And the tone of it is like an action comedy that reminds me of Jackie Chan in his prime. And it's great martial arts, like very tight Raid style story. And I think it's being distributed by the same people who did the Raid in the West. So I'm sure that will crop up in limited form somewhere.
I think there's one film that you just reminded me of obliquely that I would recommend, which is called Lucky, which I saw the night before last.
Mm.
And it has Harry Dean Stanton in it, who people might remember as for various things. He was in hundreds of films until he died very recently. But he was in Avengers as the security guard with Mark Ruffalo, who lent him his scooter, which was a cut scene, apparently, right? It's a deleted scene.
Yeah.
But it's a film that was written and produced by Harry Dean Stanton's long-term assistant, and it was a project that was made with him in mind. He'd been semi-retired for years, I think, not long after the Avengers and a few other performances. He'd kind of retired, and he was in his 90s at that stage.
Mm-hmm.
And is this sort of character portrait of a 90-year-old man living in a small town and going about his daily routine and business, but going through a bit of an existential crisis along the way. And it's just this very bittersweet, wonderful, kind of soulful film, and a really kind of beautiful send-off for an actor that, I mean, once when you broaden out from just comic book movies, he's in so many movies that film fans and geeks would have seen, from Alien to Repo Man to Escape from New York, all the way to kind of more artistic and art films like Paris, Texas. He's an iconic, legendary actor, and
he certainly had a career.
I mean, one of the best. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to think how old 91 is. There's a picture of him when he's young in army uniform, because he was in his 20s during the war. It's kind of like Stan Lee, because you kind of think, oh, he came around in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, when he was already like in his 40s.
Exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I'd recommend Lucky as well, if that might only get a small release.
Cool. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for listening. I'm not going to do the usual outro spiel because I don't have it in front of me and I stop listening by the time Joe starts saying all that stuff, to be honest.
Do you not have a pitch for me?
Unfortunately not. I will say, if you'd like to back us on Patreon, which is how we're able to record extra episodes like this, you can get involved at patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. Mike, thanks for coming on and being my sounding board slash saying all the interesting stuff while I went mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure, James, thanks.
You're always welcome. And yeah, thanks to everyone else for listening. There'll be another normal episode along soon, I assume. The others normally take care of it. I'm just here for the free tickets. So yeah, bye everyone.
Bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.